This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome, everybody, to this bonus episode of the Intercooler Podcast. Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel with you here. Now, this is in addition to our regular weekly podcast, so hopefully a little bonus treat for you all. You may know that we have a partnership with Bonhams. One of their big sales is just around the corner at the Goodwood Festival of Speed. Andrew, we've been having a leaf through the catalogue, and we're going to have a chat about some of the consignments that leapt out at us. There's some good stuff in there, isn't there?
And it's what I always love about these Bonhams Goodwood sales. It's just the variety. So we've got everything in there, haven't we? From road cars to Formula One cars to classic cars to electrified classic cars. All across the eras, all across the genres, any kind of car you could be interested in, there will be at least one example, probably more, in the catalogue. It's great. I mean, I just love getting these catalogues and just wandering through them, and I can't afford any of them, but it's just a great thing to do.
It is.
I tell you what it's like, because you can't do it anymore. You're too young even to remember this, but you know, one of the great joys when I was a kid was just looking through the classifieds in the back of Motorsport magazine. Pages and pages and pages of classifieds, and you know, racing cars and road cars and all that sort of thing. And actually, that's what auction catalogues have become these days. It's just and people, you know, kind of would actually go out and they buy the magazine for the adverts, you know, as well as the editorial. But you know, quite often it would be the ads they'd turn to first. And that's what I love about these things. It's just, you know, because you get all the big descriptions, you get the lovely photographs, and as I say, this fantastic variety of stuff. And the Bonhams Goodwood Festival sale is always, you know, one of their biggest sales of the year. And as we're about to find out, there's always a load of good stuff in it.
Yeah, not least this time. So if you want to know more about this sale, there'll be a link in the description to take you to the online catalogue, or you could just search Bonhams Cars and you'll find it that way. Later on, we're going to talk to Richard Stafford from Bonhams to find out a bit more about the auction. But first, Andrew, which car will you be fantasy bidding on come June 24th? I can just see your hand going up in the air as you sit at home.
Yes, it will definitely be a fantasy bid. I have spent so much of my life boring people to death about the Lola T70. And there is a Lola T70 in there. There's a Mark 1, which is like the original sort of Can-Am car from 1965. So these are beautiful cars with stonking great Chevy V8 engines in the back. Can-Am car, skinny tyres. So you haven't even got a get-out-of-jail-free card. And I've driven one and they're just ridiculous. They are so fast and so exciting and so dangerous, and I just absolutely love it. And actually, this one is guiding at £250,000 to £350,000, which doesn't strike me as being an enormous amount of money. Now, I don't know. I mean, sometimes you wonder whether, you know, these things are sort of priced to excite and, you know, come by the time the gavel goes down, maybe it'll be done a lot better than that. I don't know. But wow. And, you know, and it's kind of like a, I don't know whether it is a guaranteed entry to the Whitson Trophy at Goodwood, but it probably is. And this is, I think this is the very first T70 that ever got built. So it's quite an important car.
It raced at Sebring, the Sebring 12 Hours in 1965. So it's the first T70 to start a World Sports Car Championship race.
There you go. Good enough for me.
Yeah, it's eligible for the Peter Auto, for the Goodwood Revival Whitson Trophy. It's described as a potentially winning car there. It's currently fitted with a 5.7-litre Chevy small block. On the dyno, 573.5 brake horsepower.
And actually, yeah, that's a stack more than it would have had in 1965.
Yeah.
I mean, you put someone decent in that, and it'll lap Goodwood in under 1 minute 20 seconds. Can you imagine?
No, I can't, actually. It sounds terrifying, but exhilarating at the same time.
But what a way to go. I mean, you'd have so much... And the noise of the thing. I mean, you'd be deaf for weeks and, you'd just be a jelly when you got out of that, wouldn't you?
And frankly...
What an exciting thing.
You could enjoy just looking at it in your garage at home, couldn't you? Stunning
thing. Yeah. I wouldn't be doing that.
No.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, go on.
Let's switch disciplines. We're still within motorsport, but we're moving from sports car racing to Formula One. And this is probably the sort of headline consignment in this sale, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
An ex-Michael Schumacher and Riccardo Patrese 1993 Benetton Formula One car. It's a B193B, guiding at 1.1 to 1.6 million. So we really are in the realms of fantasy. But there's something about these early 90s F1 cars. I think they're among the best-looking F1 cars of all time.
They are. And there's something about... Well, I think any ex-Michael Schumacher Formula One car has a magic about it. It certainly does. Certainly does to me. And the particular thing about this one is, unlike so many of them, it works.
Yeah.
It's on the button. It's actually got an engine. I mean, it's quite often you look at these things and you think, oh, that's great, and you can't believe how cheap they are, and then you suddenly realise they don't have an engine in them. This does.
It does.
You know, and you can go and drive it.
You can go and drive it, and it does get demonstrated. It gets used. So the interesting thing about this car is that it's in sort of demo tune. It's not in race tune, which is actually, if you're not trying to win a world championship, you probably want it in demo tune, don't you? Because it means you can actually run it. It means it's got some life in it. It's not going to cost an inordinate amount of money to lap it around a circuit. It last was demonstrated at the Goodwood members meeting earlier this year. So if you were at Goodwood for the members meeting, you probably saw this car screaming around.
Yeah. I don't imagine in demo mode you're going to get bored.
No. No, you're not. It's still got a stack of power, a load of downforce. It's a 90s F1 car. It's going to rip your head off.
It is. It's going to absolutely rip your head off. Yeah.
So
wonderful thing.
This one is chassis number 4. It is a Ross Brawn and Rory Byrne car. And there's a significance there, isn't there? Those two guys working together later on. Well, at Benetton with Schumacher and then at Ferrari with Schumacher. There's a real legacy there.
This is from the year before they started winning championships, isn't it?
Yeah. A really significant time. The car was used extensively as a test car through 1993 by both drivers, Schumacher and Patrese, but Schumacher qualified it at the British Grand Prix in 93, qualifying third. So in its day, this was a competitive car. And then Patrese raced it at Silverstone. For some reason, they swapped that weekend. They swapped cars. And Patrese finished on the podium at Silverstone. So this is a podium finisher in Formula One. Two very significant drivers have been at its wheel.
It works
on the button. It's described as. So
how long do you think? So let us say we're back in fantasy land because you know that's where I spend most of my time these days. So you have a nice big safe circuit, Silverstone. You've got the Silverstone Grand Prix circuit to yourself for a day, okay? And you've got that, and you've got unlimited support and people, and you know, and let's say the car doesn't go wrong. How long do you think it would take before you could even begin to say that you'd had a proper idea of what that car was like to drive?
See, this is the thing about competition cars of this calibre. I think your neck would go and it wouldn't come back before
That's the thing.
You'd got anywhere near what the car could do.
Yeah.
I think you have to be built for it, don't you?
You do. So actually, you're not going to go, you think to yourself, oh, well, I'll just go around all day. And by the end of it, I'll be, I don't know, 10 seconds off. But you wouldn't be. Because physically, you wouldn't be capable of doing it. And frankly, even if you were, I suspect that being 10 seconds off Michael Schumacher and that, you'd need to be a really pretty good driver. I don't know. I'm sure you would. So, yeah, I don't think. But even so, you know, it doesn't mean you're not going to have the time of your life doing it.
Yeah, it'd be fun to try, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it?
It really would be fun to try. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see what this one goes for. We'll be keeping an eye on this. As I said, it's June 24th. All these cars go under the hammer with Bonhams at the Goodwood Festival of Speed. Yeah, it's a live auction. I'm sure it'll be streamed online somewhere as well, so we can watch as this thing gets bought. Oh, amazing, amazing car. So let's move on to the road. 1993 Jaguar XJ220. This is a bit of a boyhood poster car for me. I didn't have a poster. I had the Scale Electric car, which is the same thing, really, isn't it? And even then, this is probably the late 90s, it looked like a spaceship. And when you see one now, they are so long and so wide and so low.
Yeah.
They actually don't look like cars at all.
What is amazing about the XJ220 is, you look at all the cars that came out around it. So you look at things like the Ferrari F40 and the Porsche 959 before it, or the Bugatti EB110 and obviously the McLaren F1 after it. These are all million-pound cars. Yeah? All of them. They all cost, you know, £1 million minimum. And this XJ220, you know, until the McLaren F1 came out, it was the fastest car in the world. Not only was it the fastest car in the world, it advanced the art by a massive degree. Before the XJ220, there was like, you know, an F40 just done 200 miles an hour, just. You know, the XJ220 did more than 230, but in sort of road going form, did 213 miles an hour. And that is an enormous gain. They're very rare. There are only 300 and something of them. They're beautiful. It has genuine competition success. David Coulthard won his class at Le Mans in one until he was disqualified for some pathetic technicality, which I can bore you about another time. And yet, this white car is guiding at 375 to 425. So it's, you know, it's between a third and half the price of any of the other cars that were around at the time. And I think it is still trying to escape that stigma, isn't it? That, you know, when it was first unveiled in 1988, it was this four-wheel drive, 48-valve V12 behemoth. And then it came out and people would say, oh, it's got an engine from a Metro rally car in the back of it, which was pretty unfair. Well, it was also the same engine that they were using in Group C at the time. So it's a proper engine. But then Jaguar sued the owners who tried to get out of their commitment to it, and it all got very unpleasant. And I think the car is still suffering from that. I've driven one within the last couple of months. And in some ways it feels old. I mean, really old. That big clattery engine, the doors don't open very wide, and it's pretty archaic inside and that sort of thing. But, oh my goodness, you know, we think, well, this car's 30 years old, nice old thing. Don't believe it. It is, even today, but, you know, all the stuff that we've driven in the interior, this is a really fast car. I mean, think about it. This is a car which did 0-16, 3.6 seconds. With no four-wheel drive, with no sticky tyres, with no launch control, with no traction control. So, you know, with all the advantages that modern cars have, I mean, that would have been a three-second car. That is the level of performance we're talking about. And, you know, they're probably not for everyone, but, you know, I love the way they look. I love the pedigree. You know, these are Tom Walkinshaw cars. They're, you know, it's a proper, proper thing. And I think their time is still to come.
You do you? So are they sort of steadily creeping up in value along with everything else at the moment?
They or is have that yet done, to yeah. Happen? Yeah, they have been creeping up. There was, for a while, a big issue where you just couldn't get tyres for them. And so the people stopped using them, and you know, and their value has plummeted, and you know, but that's now changed. I know that I think Jaguar worked with Pirelli to get a tyre that fitted, and Don Law has got Bridgestone to reissue a version of the original tyre. So that's not a problem. So you can use them, and I think values are starting to creep up. But you know, look around, look at the other stuff you could have got at the time. And it's, they've still got a way to go. Now, I'm not saying for a moment, oh, you know, you have to go out and buy an SG220 because you'll make £500,000 in it. I don't know that you will. But it does strike me as being, given all that it achieved, given what it was, given the way that it looks, its pedigree, its performance and everything else, it does strike me as being a bit of an outlier. And it's scarcity. But, you know, maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I think they still look sensational. I'll always have a soft spot for the SG220. Okay, so let's mix it up a little bit now, because there are a couple of classics within the consignment that have been converted to electric power. Now, this is the sort of conversation that rages on, isn't it? Is that sacrilege, or does it give these cars a new lease of life and mean you can use them in ways that you wouldn't otherwise, perhaps in town? And I just wonder what your overall view of this sort of thing is. I think my view is, it isn't the case in every classic car that the engine and transmission is a part of its character, or that it adds to the driving experience. If the engine is a bit uninspiring or the gearbox is a bit uninspiring, then I think fair enough. However, when, in for instance, an odd 911, and the engine is such a core part of the driving experience that I think it's a shame to rip it out and replace it.
Yeah, I think you are absolutely correct. I think two things. One is, it's so dependent on the car. So one of the cars they've got here is an R107 Mercedes-Benz 350 SL, better known to my generation as a Bobby Ewing, because that's what Bobby Ewing used to drive around in Dallas. And that is a soft, wafty, cruisy, lovely old thing to knock about in. And in that case, why not? You know, it's not as if there's some seminal driving experience you're going to ruin. And I quite like the idea of that. The other one is a BMW 3-litre CSI. Now, to me, you know, that lovely old straight six is part of the character of that car. It's not something that I would choose to do to that car itself. But even so, the second thing I wanted to say is, frankly, I think you can do what you like as long as you can put it back. And some of these... some of these conversions involve hacking the car around so much that you can't turn it back to what it was. Others are done very sympathetically. So, you know, yeah, as long as it's the right kind of car and you can put it back, fill your boots. But as you say, you know, the idea of somebody doing, you know, and I think it's been done, an electric 911 that you can't put back. Well, not for me. But, you know, these things, and certainly the SL, I can see that completely.
Yeah, the 3-litre CSI. I mean, there will be plenty of people out there who are very comfortable with the idea of an electric version of one of those, because it probably does mean you can use it in ways that you wouldn't a conventional CSI. But I just want to talk about the way this thing looks, because there was something, maybe this was when BMW design was at its peak around the mid-70s, because it was restrained, it was very beautiful. The proportions were exquisite. I could just pour over one of those cars, just drink it all in. I'm just not sure any BMW has looked quite as good ever since.
And this car's got the Batmobile kit on it, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it looks amazing.
Stunning.
Absolutely stunning. And actually, you know, if you want something which looks absolutely incredible, but which is completely future protected, and you want it more as a beautiful thing to have rather than, you know, a dynamic thing to drive, I think there's a very good case for it. Mm. It's not what I would choose to do with it, but, you know, just because that's what I think, it's not, you know, yeah. It doesn't mean that I'm right and they're wrong.
Sure. Okay, so let's look at some of the others. I like this one because it's guiding at £30,000 to £40,000. So not fantasy realm anymore. This is a 1964 Alfa Romeo Giulia TI Super. And I think you pulled it out purely because it's called TI.
No, I didn't. I pulled it out because, I mean, this is a race car we're talking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have raced Giulia Super TI race cars for certainly 20 years. And I honestly, put me in one of those on a wet track and you won't find a happier person on the planet. These cars are so much fun to drive. I can't put into words how funny, you know, they are. You can get those things to angles. You get to the point where you think, I don't know what I'd have to do to spin this, because they always come back. Don't, if you buy it and bin it, don't blame me. But you can, the way these cars, if they're properly set up, get round a track, even if it's not wet, you know, a corner like Coppice at Donington, you approach it up that little brow and you just give it the slightest bit of right-hand lock and then instantly you're sideways. And then you just get on all the power and you just ride it out all the way through that big long corner, you know, turning left, well, with the car turning right, and it's just like that every single corner. And you can just get into these wonderful, big, extravagant drifts. And it's got that lovely twin cam Alfa engine and that wonderful 5-speed gearbox. There's nothing about those cars I don't like. I wish I was good enough to put into words how much fun they are to drive, and how, I think almost more than anything else, they illustrate the difference between fast and fun. There have been thousands of cars I've driven which are many times as fast as that and don't even come close to being as entertaining. I love those things. And, you know, I really do speak with experience, because, as I say, I've raced those things for decades. And yeah, I'm really happier than, you know, behind the wheel of one of those. So, and you know, £30,000 to £40,000. I don't know what condition it's in. I don't know whether it's ready to go or needs some work or whatever, but you know, a proper FIA car, and so eligible. There's so much stuff. You always, with these race cars, you always think, well, that's a nice idea. And then you think, well, actually, what can I do with it? And with those cars, you could do anything with it. There are so many race series all over Europe, all over the UK. And also there are so many people and so many bits, you know, affordable bits. So they're not scary to run by the standards of a lot of historic race cars. They're completely practical, usable things. And I'll stop banging on about that now, because we probably had enough of me on that subject. But I do love them. I absolutely love them.
So this one is a frequent competitor in the St. Mary's Trophy at the Goodwood Revival. And
there you
that's
go.
A two-driver, two-part race. So if you're looking, if you and a mate are looking for a way into Goodwood, maybe.
Well, it has to be a talented mate, though, doesn't it? Because the other driver has to be a pro. So as long as, yeah, you know, Gordon Shedden's your best mate or something like that, then it's great. But yeah, any car that will get you on a revival grid, I mean, to me, that's a sizable amount of money on the sticker price to begin with, isn't it? You know, yeah, you get to race at the revival. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's guaranteed an entry, but it's had one before, so maybe it'll get in again.
Yeah, fantastic. There's loads of stuff in this auction. There's some really old sort of 1920s, 1930s kit. There's sort of modern classic stuff. There's an Integrale Evo 2, a DeLorean as well. So go and have a leaf through the catalogue online. As I said, there'll be a link in the description, and you can see why we're getting so worked up. But let's now bring in Richard Stafford from Bonhams and just learn a little bit more about the sale. Richard, hello. Thank you for taking the time to join us. Me and Andrew have just been getting very excited about some of the cars that will be going up for sale on June 24th. So can you just briefly tell us what you do at Bonhams and what your involvement in the auction is?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm the head of research for the car department. So I'm both consigning cars and sort of talking to vendors and buyers, as sort of, you know, to put those sort of sales together, and also working with our cataloging team, ensuring that what we're selling is described accurately, and to sell it as best as possible, and getting all the provenance and history on these sort of cars.
Presumably that's one of the reasons that people like to buy through an auction house like Bonhams, because of the work you do to make sure everything is described properly, that it's all authentic. It's a big part of the appeal, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people come to us because they know that we're going to be describing something accurately. If we say it's matching numbers, it's because it's matching numbers, et cetera, et cetera, and making sure that we've properly researched the provenance to sell a car as best as possible.
So is the Goodwood Festival of Speed sale one of your bigger ones of the year? Is it a really significant one?
Yeah, absolutely. The Festival of Speeds, between that and the Revival, they're our biggest sales in the UK. Obviously, Goodwood being the biggest and best car event that there is in the UK, and you know, one of the biggest in the world. It's a fantastically, you know, sort of 150,000-200,000 people coming through the door. It's a fantastic place to sell cars, really.
So, Richard, can I ask, how far out do you start working on a sale like this? When do you start thinking, all right, okay, festival's coming around again, so we need to start consigning lots for that? Is it weeks, months? How long does it take?
We're usually starting about 6 months in advance, you know, sort of getting big cars advertised. You know, if something is a big, important car, you want to make sure it's got a good advertising push, going in all the magazines, et cetera, just to sort of make sure we're getting the word out there about the car, about the sale. So yeah, I'd say about 6 months, and then sort of most consignments are coming in between sort of 2 months and a month out from the sale. And then it's just getting everything photographed, properly catalogued, and sending the catalogue to print.
And presumably you have some vendors who have very firm ideas about which particular sale they want their cars to go into. Is there a type of car that suits a particular type of sale, or is it much more dependent on the diary and when these cars become available and whatever the next sale is?
There's a bit of both. I mean, we have specific sales. So we have our Golden Age of Motoring sale for pre-war cars. You know, it comes a little bit with the feel of the event. So at the Goodwood Revival, you have a few more race cars, sort of things around that pre-66 era. With the Festival of Speed, because you've got all the manufacturers there, you have a few more modern supercars, all those sort of things. Obviously, there's a variety in every sale. But yeah, the Revival, bit more competition, Festival, bit more modern, and then the pre-war sales, Bewley, and the Golden Age of Motoring. With all sales, you know, they're all marketed globally, et cetera, et cetera. But it's always trying to place a car where we think it will sell best. And sometimes we'll look at a car and someone will say, well, I want this in the Festival of Speed. And we'll say, actually, realistically, you'll get a better result for it at Bewley or Golden Age of Motoring or Revival. And it's just giving the best advice to the client.
So we've just been getting very worked up about the Benetton, the Patrasian Schumacher Benetton F1 car. And it seems the very special thing about that one is that it's on the button, it's ready to run. It's very recently been demonstrated. I think this is probably the headline lot, isn't it, for this sale?
Yeah, absolutely. So this car is, you know, it's so rare to have a Formula One car that comes to market with an actual sort of live round in it that can be taken out and demonstrated. Yeah. You know, it was demonstrated at the members' meeting this year, so only sort of 2 months ago, and has been in pretty regular demonstration use over recent years. Obviously, it's got a sort of a Motec engine management rather than the original, just to make it sort of usable by you know, by mere mortals. But no, I mean, what a fantastic thing to take out, demonstrate, and even potentially race.
So Richard, can I ask, you've got a car like that, as you say, incredibly rare, particularly one that works, and that clearly affects its value, as it should. Given how rare it is, how do you go about estimating? You know, you have to put an estimate on, you have to put a guide on these things. And this has obviously got quite a wide guide price, it's 1.1 to 1.6. But with so few prior example, so little to go on. I mean, that must be a real skill, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a case of just putting the entire team together, talking, you know, sort of between, you know, the whole team here. There's a huge amount of experience talking about sort of with, you know, with something like an E-Type, you can say, right, what are the last five sold for at auction? How does this compare? Sure. And you can get the values very accurately. With something like this, obviously, you know, there's very few Patrasi Schumacher Benetton to come to market because there's only one or two chassis a season, etc., etc. So you look at similar Formula One cars. Was it running? Was it not running? What were the results? Who drove it to what finishes in what races? And it's just sort of using those to create a feeling. But at the end of the day, the ultimate decider of the value is the bidders. You know, we can sit here and say it's worth X all day long, but the ultimate person who says this is what the car's worth, is the person who puts their hand in the air.
So it's guiding at 1.1 to 1.6. I don't know if you can put a number on it, but how much of that value is down to Schumacher, Michael Schumacher, having qualified
it? It's a good question. If he'd never driven it, what would it be guiding at?
It would be... So you put him on the spot there. If it was a Patrese, but up and running, I'd be thinking sort of probably between 700 and a million. Wow. Okay. Maybe more.
Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's the Schumacher connection does really add, you know, the fact that he drove the car, that he got a qualifying result in it. Yeah, the most successful Formula One.
That's great, isn't it? That's really cool. So which other cars are you excited about?
In the set, we've got some really cool. We've got a couple of sort of modern supercars, the SLR 722, and one of my personal favourites, Jaguar XJ220.
Yeah.
You know, those cars, I think, are seeing a bit of a resurgence at the moment. When you look at the competitors they had in period, in the EB110 and the Ferrari F40.
We have just been discussing all of this. Just saying exactly that the 220 seems a bit of an outlier at the moment, and they are creeping up, aren't they? But they've still got a way to go before they get to, you know, the values of their contemporaries.
Yeah, absolutely. To drive, they are, I think, somewhere between fantastic and terrifying, much like the other two competitors. But think they're seeing resurgence, and it's a really still remains a really beautiful shape, which I think does sort of mean a lot in the car market.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a really unfair question, because it's a question you would probably want a day to answer? But what is the market doing at the moment? There's so much sort of economic doom and gloom, and inflation's through the roof, and there's COVID, and there's Ukraine, and there are so many things to worry about. And I just wonder whether that has yet started to filter through to the classic car market, or whether there are certain types of cars which are doing better than others, and just what the sort of general Bonham's view of the way things are at the moment might be.
I mean, in terms of where the market is going, obviously there's a shift, as there's always been, towards the more modern classics. Just in terms of, as the generational differences come through, if you'd said to me 10 years ago that R34 Skyline GTRs are going to be making $300,000, I'd have said you're looking, but that's where they're going, because the generation that grew up watching Fast and the Furious are now sort of earning and have got the sort of money to say, well, look, I want the car that I watched on the TV growing up. In terms of the current market, and we had a very successful sale at the Goodwood Members Meeting back in April. That was 93-94% sold.
Yeah.
And with some really good prices, really good bidding. I think sort of with interest rates and inflation, all those sorts of things, I think there's actually a lot of people thinking, maybe I want to sit my money in something that sits in the garage, is a bit of fun. It's not sat in the bank. If it goes up, great. Otherwise, I've got something fun in the garage that I can use.
Brilliant. Well, that's really insightful stuff. I think it's the variety in the cars that have been consigned that's sort of most compelling. There's such a mix in there. I've said before, everyone listening, go and follow the link in the description. You can see all the cars, because there's a fascinating mix of stuff in there. Me and Andrew are going to be sat either at Goodwood or at home, just fantasy bidding on that Schumacher car, raising our hands, hoping no one notices. And it'll just be really interesting to see what that fetches, what all the other cars go for. So Richard, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. And I hope everything goes well for the Bonham sale at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, June 24th.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for having me.
Hmm. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.